Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Bill Murray, and apparently I'm going to host tonight. I was waiting for someone else to show up, and when they didn't, I was auditing the show. I jumped on here. So we're starting a couple of minutes late, but that's okay. Our guest for the evening, our special guest, is from Marion, Massachusetts, Matt Packness, and he is here waiting in the wings, and we're going to bring him on in just a second. He's a survivor of child abuse that occurred when he was around 9 years old. He ended up being a senior management consultant with 6 years of college football coaching, 10 years of playing football, 5 championship seasons, and so forth. And his focus now is on lessening bullying in the workplace. He was a former assistant coach at Penn State under Joe Paterno, as a matter of fact, and he's spoken publicly numerous times about being abused as a child. We're going to hear his story tonight, and we'll start at the beginning part of his story and move forward into his life, and we'll end up in the last third of the show. We'll talk about the solution for him and the work that he does today and so forth. But I am joined by a panel of people I'm grateful are here with us, and let me introduce them first, then we'll get Matt on the air. The first of them that called in a little early was Mary Havens from Alaska. She's our Alaska ambassador. She's currently in Tucson, I know, because she's a bit of a nomad and she travels around. I think she's going to spend the winter in Tucson, which is, I recommend if you live in Alaska. And she's always a welcome participant on these shows. Mary Havens from Alaska. Mary, thanks for calling in tonight.
Well, you're welcome, Bill, and thanks for the great introduction. And yes, it probably is a little warmer here in Tucson, although the last couple of days have been a little challenging. But I look forward to the show tonight. I got online and read about the guests we're going to speak with tonight. So thank you.
Well, glad you're joining us. My cousin, Madeline, who I've tried to introduce you to, showed me some pictures of it snowing. It snowed in her backyard in Tucson. She couldn't believe it. So anyway, all right. Our next panelist, Mary, is Carol Levine. She needs no introduction, but she'll get one anyway. And she is calling in, of course, from Northwest New Jersey in the new home that she calls in from now. She's getting herself settled there, doing very well. She's the author of a book, Panic Child. Mary, I didn't mention your book's name, so I should mention it, and it's The Shadows in My Heart. Both these ladies have books.
Yes.
Carol Levine is the author of Panic Child, and she goes out and does a lot of presentations in the Northwest New Jersey and Northeast Pennsylvania area, and is another one of our hosts. She's actually trailing tonight, so she's sort of co-hosting tonight, and I welcome her to the show as well. Carol, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
No, you're quite welcome, Bill. Had I known that someone wasn't going to show up, I would have run the show. But I am here.
No, I understand. I understand that. Our last panelist for right now is Bobby Hyde from Florida. He hails from Miami. He's a regular on the show and panelist numerous times. sometimes numerous times a week. He's here with us tonight. Sometimes has some background noise in his life and sometimes not, but let's find out. Bobby Hyde, thank you very much for calling in and welcome to the show. Bobby, are you there? We're not hearing you if you are.
Here I am.
Here you are. Going to be able to participate tonight?
Yeah.
Good.
I just didn't realize.
All right. Thank you, Bobby. So we have Mary, Carol, and Bobby with us, and I'm Bill, and I'm, of course, calling in from Los Angeles. Let me reintroduce and then bring on the air our special guest. He is Matt Packness. He's from Marion, Massachusetts, which I believe is close to, we'll find out, maybe Buzzards Bay or somewhere like that, I think. He's a survivor of child abuse that occurred when he was 9 years old, started then, and ended up being a senior management consultant with 6 years of college football coaching, 10 of playing football, 5 championship seasons, and his focus is on lessening bullying in the workplace, and that's he has a consulting company that does that kind of work. He was a former assistant coach at Penn State under Joe Paterno, and I'm sure he has a story or two about that we'll get to later. But he's publicly spoken about his being an abused child many times. So let me bring him on the air and welcome him back, welcome him to the show for the first time as a NASCA family member, Matt. Hey, Matt, thanks so much for being here tonight, and thanks for your patience.
Thanks, Bill. No problem. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely. You sound great.
Good. Good.
So we're gonna start this. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say hello to. I had Mary, Carol, Bob, and Bob, right?
Mary, Carol, and Bobby, right?
Okay, yeah. Good.
All right. Now there may be other people that join us in a moment or two because we do keep the phone line open, and if they want to call in, they can. In fact, let me remind them of that. The number to call for them is the same number we all use every night, 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118. And if there are people who want to join us, I can bring them on later. I know there are people out there listening, and sometimes the spirit moves them to make a call, and that's fine too. So that may or may not occur. But we're starting with 3 panelists, all of them experienced panelists, Matt. And what we want you to do is feel really comfortable being with us because we've heard you wouldn't believe how many stories. In fact, this is episode 2045 of this style of show. It's the Monday to Friday style show. And then we do a Sunday show of a different style. And we've done over 550 of those shows. So we've done a couple of shows here. and I want you to feel comfortable. You should also know that if you are interested, the show is being recorded as we do it, and it'll become available within about 20 minutes of its finishing. As a podcast, an on-demand podcast, and it'll be in our library basically forever and ever with the same link all the time. So we'll be happy to let you know how to find that if you need to. It's actually the same information and so forth that's in our library under the 4th mm-hmm. of January. All right, Matt, we're going to start with your early life. And I usually ask people to be chronological in how they describe what happened to them, sort of their life story, and be sure to use expressions of how things felt, because that's often what people can identify with, sort of the feelings and the thinking of the child and the adolescent and the young adult and so forth, because our stories may be very different, but that's kind of the universal thing for us, is how we felt and thought and so forth. So, Let's just find out from you, to be getting the ball rolling, what kind of family you were born into and grew up in, what kind of community and social structure was there?
I grew up probably not far from where Carol is right now, in a town called Madison, New Jersey. And you live near there?
I lived in Florham Park.
That's where you live right now?
No, that's where I did live, though. I know right where you are.
Yeah. Hanover Park High School. My dad lived on Ridge Road, and my mother's actually buried in one of the two big cemeteries right there, mm-hmm. right across from the Bisco now. Used to be the. Anyhow, Yeah, I went to the high school there in Madison. My mom grew up in Madison. My grandfather was a state trooper who actually fought in World War One, came back and was hired as trooper number 83 in New Jersey under Norman Schwarzkopf's dad. And he was basically the state troopers were initiated to enforce prohibition. Ironically, my dad's father owned a brew pub up in Dover, New Jersey. But he did a lot of different things. They're both very handy. And they lived in Hanover, but my mom, or Madison High School, was a regional school at the time. That's where they met, and that's where they fell in love. And my dad and mom were both the first members of their family to go to college. They went to Rutgers and Douglas, respectively, which now is all one, but Douglas used to be the sister school of Rutgers. And then they went around the country a little bit, I guess, with the Army, and then came back to Madison to settle. And I have an older sister who's born about 4 years older than me. I was born in 1962 on the day John Glenn orbited the Earth. And I'm looking at a picture with me and him right here. He received an honorary degree from Brown University a couple of years ago, about 20 years ago now, because he went back up into space at the age of 77. And so I have a sister that's about 4 years older than me, and I have a brother that's 5 years younger than me. And when I was 9 years old, so my mother was four and my sister was 13, my mom was diagnosed with malignant melanoma. She had a mole on her back that looked like Long Island, and it was like at the base of her rib cage. And so she went in for a biopsy, and the guy had no bedside manner, and we were with her, her three children. And he said, I think that's melanoma. And if it's melanoma where it is, you're looking at about a year. And she just broke down. And I just remember, not really knowing what was going on, but realizing this was really serious. My mom was crying. Now, my parents had what I know now and what I knew then. My brother and sister were safe from it, but I wasn't. We had a violent family. My mom experienced domestic violence. She was 5'3". My dad was about 6'2", probably about 260 pounds. And I just read something today. I guess there was something in my spirit that he didn't really like. And I think it was because I emulated, or I was like my mom. We're very gregarious. She was voted most versatile and friendliest, or most liked when she was a senior in high school, and I was voted most versatile and friendliest when I was a senior in high school. But there was something about that I don't think my dad liked, and I think that's what bullies, the best often employees are the ones that get bullied and abused rather than celebrated for their talents, because they trigger an incompetence or an insecurity in the bully. But I dealt with that starting at probably about 4 years old. And I'm sorry, jump in anytime. But
let me just ask you a question, Matt. Your voice sounds a little bit tinny, and I'm wondering if you're on a speakerphone or something, perhaps.
I'm on a Bluetooth.
That's okay. It's not bad. It's just a little tinny. I just wondered. All right, you're bullying.
Go ahead.
Try a different configuration? No, it's okay. We're fine. Your dad was sort of the model for the bullying that you experienced. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but, my mom, it would come in waves. Like when I was at, I think when he got stressed, his dad had a drinking issue. And so my dad,
right,
I think, grew up in a pretty hellacious situation. And he tried to offer us a very stable environment, but the demons, I guess, couldn't be kept in. And the back of my head, I think, was the main target, starting from as early as I can remember, maybe third or fourth, when I was 3 or 4 years old. And I'd be at, like, big family get-togethers where there was a lot of stress, I guess, for my dad and my cousins, and I would just love it. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this hand, this massive hand, my dad was a NCAA weight thrower, so he was pretty strong. and it, you know, would send my head in, usually into the table or into a plate. And, you know, obviously I started pulling out my hair when I was about second grade, and I just thought I had a lot of problems with me. I thought they were all my problems. I didn't, you know, really didn't come into clear focus until I was like in my 40s and 50s. But all these issues about anxiety, I had OCD, I'd pull my hair out. It was all because I didn't know when I was going to get attacked. And so with my mom was my advocate. She was a loving person. She was a loving person to my father. She was very gracious. She was very forgiving. But she was also stuck. And so she was, you know, financially dependent on my father. And so, you know, she wasn't going anywhere. And then she got very sick. So she went in to get her lymph system removed. And it required over 2,000 stitches. And she came back out. And, you know, she was in the hospital a lot. And my father really didn't, you know, we didn't really communicate much. We just sort of, I think my grandparents came in and helped. And I remember we had gotten a new puppy, and I came home for lunch to walk the dog, and I was nine, so it was like the beginning of my fourth grade year, maybe September, October, and my mother, again, had just come out of all these surgeries, and I guess she was hemorrhaging, and so there was an ambulance in our driveway, and my grandparents' car was there, so I was like, wow, what's going on? So I went up there and onto the front porch, and my dad just handed me my dog's leash and said, walk, Misty. And so I walked the dog around the corner, and I saw my mom in it. She was in the gurney. You know, they're putting her in the gurney, getting ready to put her in the ambulance. So as I went around the corner, I guess she had told the driver, whatever you do, don't pass my son. But they went by me. And I just remember, you know, in the old ambulances had the big window in the back. So this was around 1971. And the person in the ambulance would actually be sitting up looking out the window. And we just locked eyes. And I figured that was it. You know, that was the last time I'd see her. She didn't wave to me. I noticed it probably intentionally because she didn't want me to think she was saying goodbye. But I figured that was it. And so I went back. I didn't know what was really wrong. I knew something was really wrong, but I didn't know what specifically. They didn't really talk to us about anything. So I went back in, and my grandmother had prepared a ham sandwich for me. And I started, you know, we didn't eat ham. So I just didn't, it's not that I didn't like it. I just said, well, can I make something for myself that might, you know, I might like? And all of a sudden, boom. The boom came down on the back of my head, and my grandmother, who was my father's mother, and my grandfather, who was my, you know, they were just like shaking their heads, and my nose broke, and, you know, I had blood all over my face, and I just went back to school, and no one approached me. You know, I was at school, and I didn't eat. I was probably all red, and that's one of the reasons, you know, I sort of, people gravitate towards me when I'm working as a consultant or when I'm working in organizations. And I guess I must inspire some sort of comfort in them because they share these stories, these horrific stories about being bullied by managers in the workplace. But the reason I do that is because then something magical happened. I came home that night, and my dad and my mom were supposed to go over to my neighbor's party, and my best friend, Nye, and his parents often had parties, and my dad said, go over, tell Ms. Lassiter that we can't make the party. And I go, Gwen, I don't know if I can deal with that. That's going to be pretty. And so I said, can't you just call her? And he goes, he leered at me, you know, very threatening. So I said, well, I remember what happened at lunchtime. So I said, I went over there, and I started walking. Now, Ms. Lassiter was tough. She was a disciplinarian. She was from India. Nine's dad was African American. His mom was from India. And she opened that door, and I could see she was sort of leering at me. And I said, oh, here I go again. But she was a trained nurse, and she, you know, sensed, obviously, she obviously saw me saw my face and everything, and she, you know, I could see just a warmth in her, and she embraced me. And then, you know, I just hugged her and I just broke down. And that was, you know, I say three or four times, I think I really felt the presence of God on earth. And that was one of them. And gave me a sense that, you know, you don't know who's out there. There are good people out there.
Right.
And so,
right.
You know, I was just 9 years old. And so then obviously the family's in turmoil. And I started, my grandfather tried to spend a little more time with me. We built a tremendous treehouse together. Because he knew that, you know, there was a bad connection there between me and my dad.
Right.
And
let me slow you down a little bit, Matt, because I do want to get the panel involved. And you've told us plenty for them to perhaps make a comment or ask a question, which is what you'll find they'll do several times through the show. I'll invite them to do this. And I want to remind the panel that, you know, the expression of how something felt, or how, for you, Matt, or how what your thinking process was, that's kind of important to the listener, because that's what they identify with. And just like you, you find it, that people are attracted to you because of your willingness to tell your story, in the workplace and so forth. That's also going to happen tonight, as it does every night on our show, with the newcomer who's out there. Yeah.
Just to clarify, I don't tell a story in the workplace.
Whatever, consulting or whatever, whatever you said before. I mean, that's what one survivor talking to another can almost immediately gain their trust. It takes very little time, and it's amazing how quickly this can happen. So we're hoping for that for the listeners tonight, of course, as well. Mary Havens, I'm going to go to you first, and then Carol, and then Bobby, and we're going to invite each of them to make a comment or ask a question about what they've heard so far, and you can interact with them as we go, Matt. So Mary Havens, you're up first. What would you like to say to Matt?
Well, first of all, Matt, I'm so sorry that you had to experience that as a child. It brings tears to my eyes, just the thought of someone just striking you with no reason, just because. And at least when I was growing up, I knew what I was getting a spanking for, which didn't happen real often because I learned quickly not to do things I shouldn't. But I do also associate with you in the fact that people are drawn to me. In fact, they used to call me Ann Landers when I was in high school. I didn't think about how much people do come to me, and I listen to their heartache. The problem I had was that I never had anyone that would listen to my story. But I would always be really good about listening and helping others, and I can see where that would be a part of your character, probably that your mom passed on to you that drew others to you. I have a couple of questions. One, I had never ever heard of a lymph system being removed, which sounds absolutely horrific. And were you there and seeing your mom in a lot of pain during all this time?
Absolutely. They I guess the lymph or leg that she, I want to say elephantitis, but edema, I think that's what the term is. One of her legs, my mom died in 1979, so I don't remember exactly which one, but was after the surgery. There was no fluid control, so one of her legs, and that's because they removed all the lymph tissue. It was all infected, so she was basically stage four, and she did get it. You know, they gave her about a year, but she lived 8 years, and she was strong, and she had to put up with all my dad's bullshit. You know, they fight every morning. He wasn't a loving husband to her. And, you know, that's another reason, you know, I think I feel guilty for not standing up more for her but we were all sort of like, my siblings weren't hit, but I definitely was. So I think I was like in a circus, you know. I was like those lions that are caught and they just pace back and forth and back and forth. And a good part of the story comes up, so I don't want to jump ahead, but I do want to clarify, Bill. I do not disclose the depth of my traumas when I'm with clients or in a workplace because I worry about triggering people. But I think they can sense in me an empathy that is from all this, you know, and that's what gets expressed. And then I can certainly tell them about bullying experiences that I've seen in the workplace. But, you know, I really don't disclose unless I'm in an environment like this where people know what they're going to be hearing and they know that they can, you know, if there's a trigger alert or whatever, they can soothe themselves. But, yeah, I'd be very, very cautious about sharing my story openly like that with people because,
understood. You know. Understood. Mary, you had another quick question?
No, that was it. He actually answered my other question
Thank you, Mary.
His explanation.
Okay.
But you're
good,
welcome.
Good. So let's go on to Carol. Carol, a comment or a question for Matt?
Well, first of all, I want to welcome you to the show. And it's nice to speak to someone who lived near me at one time. I didn't live there all the time in Florham Park, but because I'm from New York, but I did live in Florham Park for some years, I guess around ten years, whatever. And I'm so sorry, so sorry you went through all of this. And quite frankly, I know too well all about domestic violence and being hit also. So, you know, it's a tough thing that you went through. And I'm so happy that you're here. I'm so happy that you made it through. And I think that sometimes, you know, people can, sense, because I there were a couple times that I did tell my story to complete strangers, which I've never mentioned before. But there was something about the way they were speaking to me. I felt safe. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just all go blah, 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 blah. So I know what you're talking about. I'm thankful that your grandparents, came to your aid, and also that lady next door, the nurse.
My friend's mother.
Thank you, Carol. Yeah, mm-hmm. We appreciate that. Thank you, Carol. Bobby Hyde, mm-hmm. You're up next. Do you have a question or a comment about what you've heard so far?
Here I am. Yep. Welcome to the NASCA show, first of all. And second, it's nice to hear that you're equating this bullying with in today's day with people who are control issues and people who begrudge mm-hmm. others some even place within their space. You know, that's really, really where bullying comes from. And I'm really had several years speaking in NASCA, understanding where I came from and listening to people talk and evaluating myself.
Thank you,
Bobby. And tell the rest of your story, please.
All right, and I'm going to ask the question that I thought maybe somebody else would ask. But, Matt, in this early part of your life, if you could tell us again, I'm interested in how you felt and thought and what actions you might have taken even as a youngster to try and avoid some of this surprising punishment that you got. What was your thinking and what was your feeling about it?
Well, it was confusion, I think, more than anything else because, you know, my mom was very loving, and at times, you know, there was like this appearance outside that we were like this Leave It to Beaver family. And, you know, my dad could be good, you know, with the family. But then I'd like count the days, and it usually wasn't more than one or two days that there'd be this explosion. And again, I was pretty much the recipient of a lot of that. I did catch him, you know, and see him. I was aware that he was abusing my mother, and I don't think my siblings were. But you know, so that's, you know, observing that kind of thing and seeing that kind of thing is not too good as well. I was just in like, and then I started to retreat, I think. And I also wanted to say that my dad's very big and I inherited his size. I'm actually bigger than my father, but my mom was tiny. And I grew up in this town. The reason why I think they wanted us to come back and grow up this town, because it was, you know, supposedly a nice, safe town, and it had a great football program. And so, like, any big kid, even, you know, there are so many other factors that go into it, was naturally expected to play football in Madison. And so when I was growing up, you know, people just saw my size. And they saw my strength. I was good in gym. I was good in all my classes, actually, up till about fourth grade. And it just came easy, and everything was just natural. And I would go to school where I think my family really existed. I loved my classmates. I remember, like, Dee Dee Kington. There were a couple other classmates I had that, you know, they made me smile every day. I had a really good friend, Todd Dare, who, you know, he had hearing aids. Kids pick on him, so I sort of watched out for him. So I was like a protector. I just sort of naturally, but in home, I didn't. It was like almost like trying to get on the radio station where you try to get in a clear frequency, and I just didn't know what to read. So I just became protective, and I distracted myself. I you know, would pull my hair. I'd be very anxious starting in third grade, or second or first grade, and then. When my mom was sick and she was back in the hospital, I was in a treehouse, and again, I was about nine, and a neighbor started spending more and more time with me, thinking that, you know, this guy sees what the problem with the family is, just trying to be nice. But then that guy started sexually abusing me, and in my treehouse, by the way, that was built as my, like, little safe haven to keep me away from my dad. So it's really sort of tragically comic in a way. And that went on, you know, and that first started, it was a grooming process, that, you know, that person, you know, just built sort of an alliance and a trust and spent more and more time and then started abusing me. And then I completely went into like this, every waking hour, I was just consumed with OCD, which is just these impulsive thoughts. I had them aligned with good people and bad people, and I was trying to control my own world, I guess, with my own head. And I had just impulsive thoughts, and then I had it was like a mental illness, mental sickness from all the stress and anxiety I was under. And I had nowhere to go. I obviously couldn't tell my dad because I was afraid he'd kill me, you know, that if you know, or he'd kill, you know, he'd blame me for it. I couldn't tell my mom because she was sick. So this went on. So it started in fourth grade. This went on to about seventh grade. So I was pretty much a walking corpse, and miserable as a child, you know, but I could put on... There were times like, you know, I started playing football in fourth grade, but I was over the weight limit and it was just too much stress because a lot of coaches yelled and I worried that they were going to, you know, it would lead to what was happening in my house. So even though I absolutely loved practice, I dominated practice, I didn't play. I quit. And obviously when I quit, I got beat. I got another beating because it was a bad thing for my that happened to my dad. So then, I really just was coasting. You know, I think they were just passing me through. I was just trying to get, I was truant probably. I was afraid to go out of the house. I picked like 2 quarter to 50 cent size piece bald spots on my head. And then finally, you know, my mom sort of like got out of that horrific original state and she was somewhat stabilized. And so in seventh grade, she said, man, this kid is, you know, he can't push it. So I started seeing a psychologist. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me. And that guy started, you know, talking to me, and I said what was going on. Now, I don't know what the laws were at that time, But I told them I was being abused. And when I said that, when I told them, you know, it was like this million-pound weight came off my shoulders. But he didn't – there was no reporting. Like, he encouraged me to stop it, and which I did. But he also told me that he had asked my parents, my dad, if he wanted to come in to work on our relationship, which I was very eager to have happen. And he said my father didn't. He refused. So that told me, you know, and I think that was like seventh or eighth grade. That told me that my dad didn't really like me. So I was able to compartmentalize. I was able to stop the molestation. Then I became a wrestler. I was, by the time I was in eighth grade, I weighed about 200 pounds, and I was about 6'2". And I was, you know, stronger and bigger than most of my friends' parents. And I went out for wrestling. I was undefeated my first year. I was just sort of natural at it. And my dad asked me if I, you know, he said, I think I could wrestle. And he still outweighed me by about 50 or 60 pounds. So now I'm in eighth grade, and my grades are still bad, but now I'm going to school every day. I'm not afraid to go out of the house, and I'm starting to stabilize a little bit. So I wrestled him, and I kicked his ass up and outside the house. I mean, and I said, you want to wrestle again? He said, no, he never touched me again after that. So,
yeah.
You know, all these amazing good things, empowering things happened to me about when I was like 13 or 14. And I was, the other great thing that happened to me was I just was big and I was athletic. And so that naturally made people think that I was, even though I was tormented and I had been tormented internally, the appearance was that this guy is really, but the other dangerous thing that does is that no one, everyone saw me as a threat. No one could really understand that I could go, you know, all the pain that I was going through. And that's why I try to look underneath the, you know, behind the yellow brick road in people's lives, you know,
and not
assuming something's bad, but appreciating that.
Yeah.
So do you want to take another little break?
I do, and I want to comment as we go to Mary first, but I want to comment myself. I was sexually abused starting around a similar age, and I became a bully, I became a protector myself. In other words, one of the reactions was whenever I saw someone else being bullied, I'd step in the middle of it, and I would say, oh, yeah, you want to take me on like you're trying to take him on, that kind of thing, and I'd dare the big guy. Sometimes we'd end up, you know, on the side of the school punching each other out. But I stood up for the weaker ones because inside I was weak. I knew the story of Bill. No one else did, what had been going on with me and how damaged I was. And I hated that I was being taken advantage of in the way I was. So I wouldn't let anybody else, if I saw it happening to them, I'd get in the middle. You know, I'd and just challenge the bigger kid. I don't care. And I'll tell you the honest truth is we often became friends, the big kid and I, after the fight. And it was amazing. But I identified with that. And let me go to Mary Havens first, then Carol, then Bobby. Let them have a comment or a question.
You.
Sorry?
I said they respected you for standing up for them.
Yeah, exactly. Bullies don't like people who are strong. They like people who are weak. That's who they go after.
Yes.
I mean, they respect you after you show your strength, but what they're looking for is people they can prey on. All right, Mary Havens, what would you like to ask or what comment would you like to make of Matt at this point?
Well, because I feel like he was the target. And being the target and knowing what was going on around you, did you feel real protective of your sister and brother? And like even with your mom, did you feel like you could intercede when your dad was bullying her and she was sick?
You know, his call just dropped off. I'm sure he'll call back. So we'll bring him back as soon as he does. Mary, but
okay.
I don't know. Okay. I know his brother and sister were able to avoid it. I don't know why that he was picked on, and we'll find out when he comes back. In the meantime, I really strongly identify with his being abused. What I I hope we'll find out a little bit about, maybe through the questioning now, for maybe somebody else, but his mother protected him, you know, which is great. And his father didn't and wasn't interested in being a part of the solution, so to speak, but his mother did. All right, Matt, you're back. Mary Havens asked, if you were part of the protection process for your brother and your sister, did you help protect them, and is that why they weren't abused as much as you were physically?
I don't know. And, you know, my dad's even said, he goes, you know, I never touched Pam or Judd, but Matt, that was a different story. And so, you know, you'll get the full story as we progress, but they didn't really need my protection. I mean, there was like a fine relationship there, that wasn't with me for some reason.
Understood.
I don't know why.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But I think I would. I'm sorry. They did, and as I progress, my dad got involved with a woman not long after my mom died, and they got married within the year, and that was between my senior and year in high school and freshman year in college. And I will reflect on a story where I did protect my sister in one situation there. So the one time that I did see my father approach my sister, I definitely got in the middle and he backed off because I was about, you know, I was just going into my freshman year in college and I was,
We're going to do your adolescent years, your teenage years, and maybe even your young adulthood in the next segment. But let's go to Carol. Carol, a question or a comment for Matt?
Well, I just want to say that many times, you know, kids need outlets because they have been so abused or they are in the process of being abused. And many times we do turn to, you know, athletic. And I was very athletic also. And I was being bullied in school. But I must say, the kids became very frightened of me because I was so tough. So that was my protection, you know. And I scared everybody, including myself. I think I even scared the gym teacher. That's all I wanted to say. I want to listen more to your story. Then I'll have some questions for you.
Thanks, Carol. All right, we go to Bobby Hyde in Florida. Bobby, a question or a comment for Matt about this part of his life? Bobby?
Hi, Bill. Yeah, I don't have much to say about this part of the narrative. I'll listen some more. Thank you.
Okay, no problem. No problem. Matt, we'll go on now with your... with your teenage years, I guess, or your high school years, let's say. And,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's all right.
Yeah, I think the two or three things that I really pulled from, I think I saw that gentleman for about 2 years. And except in the summer, obviously. But... The other thing that he did was he gave me a bunch of intelligence tests. And the other thing I wanted to comment on too, Bill, before I talk about this, is that you made an active choice to be a protector. Like a lot of times people assume that if you've been abused or sexually molested, it's like a vampire syndrome. And that's not the case. Only a very, very tiny percentage of people that were abused turn around and decide to abuse other people. Of the people that do abuse, many of them have been abused, but only a tiny portion of the people that have been abused repeat the cycle. And that's both with physical violence and sexual abuse. And so I think it is an act of choice. What I think happens is in the abuse case, if kids first try or make a choice to repeat the cycle, it then becomes almost like an addiction, chemical addiction, and it's like alcohol or violence or whatever, and they can't stop. It becomes a very dangerous thing. But anyhow, with back to my story. So I left you off about eighth grade, and it made me take the intelligence test two or three times because I think, based on my schoolwork and you know how I was doing in school, which is not a reflection. There's so many different factors that go into it, which isn't necessarily a reflection of intelligence. He gave me these tests, and he's like, wait, take that again. And so I took it again, and he said, you know, it made me feel really good because it made me feel like I wasn't stupid. I felt like I was a real idiot for having all those things happen to me. And, you know, I blame myself, naturally. It was overwhelming. All those things happening, my mom's illness, observing domestic violence, being a victim of domestic violence, being sexually abused, all those things happening is just, it's too much for a kid to process. So I was just, you know, like I said, my head and my brain were like a radio out of frequency. I did enjoy spending time with my dog, friends. I would enjoy athletics, anything where I had a release like that where I could move around, I felt really good about. I remember laughing at some movies, but in general, it was a pretty sad time for about 4 or 5 years. And then I had been, and this is another ironic sort of sad story. My dad was one of the, or I guess at the time he got it, he was like with the youngest Eagle Scout in New Jersey. And so, like, he went through all the merit badges faster than anybody at, up until that time. And I think, you know, he graduated high school in 53, I think. So it was a long time ago. But anyhow, you know, he had a great experience. So I joined the Scouts. And the Scoutmaster was a bully. He would just, like, he was horrific to me. I remember I played a little football in sixth grade, but I had to play with kids that are a little older than me. And I fractured my kneecap, so I had to be in a cast. So I got the cast off, and that week we were going on a camp out. And I said, all right, I'd like to go. And I said, but I can't do much hiking. He goes, all right, come on. So I go on the camp out, and the guy goes, come on, we're going on a night hike. And I go, instead, I just got my leg out of a cast. You know, I'm in sixth grade, and I can't really move. I'm worried I'm going to trip, and I'll break the bone again because it's tender. He goes, come on. You know, he made me do life. And the guy was just a complete jerk. And it was like 2 years, and he wasn't married, and he was a high school teacher, and he lived with his mother, and he would take one of my friends every summer and go with him on a long motorcycle hike. And I was like, this guy is a jerk. And so my mom said, yeah, absolutely, get out. My dad, he was like friends with my dad. So I went to another troop. Turns out that guy was like a serial pedophile, and he was abusing a lot of my friends. That's not the guy that abused me, but it's crazy because, you know, again, my dad didn't really see the bad in the guy. So I went to this other troop, and I ended up going to Philmont, which is a scout reservation down in New Mexico. And so this is between my freshman and sophomore years. Now, freshman year, I was selected captain twice on the football team. We had a good football team. I was undefeated in wrestling. I think I broke a freshman discus record in the spring. And so I felt really good about athletics, and my grades were stabilizing, but they weren't good. And then I went to Philmont. And Philmont, you hike like 10 to 15 miles a day with a backpack, about 40-pound pack on your back, and So you end up hiking, you know, depending on the trek you take and the difficulty, maybe 120 to 200 miles over maybe a 10 to 14-day period. And every night you have to take all your smellables, your toothpaste, your food, your soap, put it in a burlap bag, hang it between trees so the bears won't come in your tent. And I could hear the bears at night. Being from Jersey, I was a little nervous. You know, I didn't sleep that well. And so the last night we were supposed to merge with another group from New Jersey. We had 11 in our group. There was 11 in that other group. And it was a wonderful experience. You know, you're out there pushing yourself, testing yourself after the, you know, hellacious previous 4 or 5 years of my life. I was like, wow, things are starting to turn. Well, the last morning they have what really brands the reservation is this Tooth of Time. And it's just an outcropping of rock that sticks out of a mountain. And it looks like a tooth jutting out, and so they call it the Tooth of Time, and tradition is that if you're going on that trek, you hike all night, and you see the sunrise, on the Tooth of Time, and then you go on the base camp, and that's the end of your program. It's a wonderful way to end your 2 weeks. And so we merged with this other group, and the other scoutmaster, we had 11 boys, I think 10 boys and one adult in the group. He got us lost at the base. So we started bushwhacking. We got to this base of boulders, like a boulder field. It was a mountain boulders. We just started climbing. And so we had 22 kids in the middle of the night. It was like 2:33 in the morning going up these boulders. And we got about three-quarters of the way up, and there was no path. And a couple of the boulders became loose. They went down. No one got hurt. But the gentleman, their leader, started having a panic attack, and he started screaming and shaking. And somehow been towards the front there, and I went over to him, and I comforted him, and I said, "But you know, you can't do this. This is going to really scare the kids. You can't." I tried to take him out of. We were spread out all across the mountain, and I was sort of close to the front, so I was trying to keep that compartmentalized and away from the rest of the kids. So I said, "I'll try to find a path." So I went back, and I found like in the middle of this rock boulder fields that's the side of a mountain, sort of this area that was sheer rock, and it had some growth coming out of like scrub maples and things like that. So you could hang on to those and climb as we went up. And we all made it up to the top, and then we got to the top, and there was this crevice, and it could have been 10, could have been 100 feet deep, but there was just enough space on either side of the crevice to like put our hands. You couldn't even put your feet there. So we went across like parallel beams. It was about 10 feet wide. And like I said, there could have been bears down there. It was unbelievably scary. But we all made it across there. Everyone made it safely. No one got hurt. And then at the other end of that was a little hill. And then I looked up, and the Tooth of Time was behind us. So we had actually climbed a mountain that wasn't supposed to be climbed in front of it, the Tooth of Time. But we got there just as the sun was rising. And I didn't see the sunrise. I passed out. But the whole way up that mountain, I was talking to God, and I said, "Get me out of this. I'll do whatever you want
right.
me to do."
Right.
And so I got just to myself. You know, I wasn't talking. No one else could hear me. And so when I woke up, I experienced this peace that I had never had. It was like this unbelievable, just like, tranquility. And then we walked down from that perch. There was a very well beaten path, broad path down to base camp. So I guess this was a very common place for people to come. It wasn't far from base camp to just sort of have a view of the Tooth of Time, which was behind us. And so, you know, it really energized me, that whole experience. And then I got back, I think the previous 5 years, the best grade I might have gotten was maybe a B minus. Everything else were C's and D's, maybe an F occasionally. After that experience, and after my first year, and after getting the counseling and being around some decent people, I think the lowest grade I got, you know, I sort of like calmed down. And then I became the only sophomore starter on the our football team, varsity starter, and we were 11-0. We were state champs, and I led a 1,000-yard all-state running back. And, you know, I was a sophomore, and so that was a pretty big deal. And then I was a wrestler, varsity wrestler as a sophomore, and then I was varsity track as a sophomore. But my grades, I think the lowest grade I got over the next 3 years was like a B+. Everything else was A's. And it was just like, I had missed so much school and so much background, but I don't know what happened. It was just like I would sit in the classroom, and it was as if I'd been there already. The stuff just sort of came to me naturally. And I really responded well to our coach. He was an ex-Marine, and he demanded excellence. And, you know, there was no fluff. There wasn't a lot of rah-rah. It was just preparation after preparation and execution. He was a Lombardi discipline, but it was hard love. He wasn't a bully. He was just tough as nails. And I really responded to that. And that, I think, all those things happened. So the next 3 years, I ended up being a 3 year starter on three consecutive 11-0 teams. And my senior year, I was one of the captains. And, you know, I'd been elected to go to Boys State, things like that were just unfathomable 5 years earlier when it appeared the end of my life was near. And then my mom, she relapsed my junior, and then she went to the hospital in August of my senior year. And so every day after practice, I would go see her in the hospital. And I had to say goodbye to her. I guess we were 8-0. It was the, you know, November 10th. The days were the same as the calendar year this year. And I was called in. I said, "You got to say goodbye. She's losing consciousness." And she, you know, she's just sick. So I said goodbye. And she just kept on repeating. The only thing she kept on saying to me was, "You're a good boy. You're a good boy. You're a good boy." And so, goodness, I think, is something I've always strived for. And get rid of a book by a guy named M. Scott Peck called, he wrote The Road Less Traveled, but also he wrote a book called The People of the Lie. And it's a real good dissection of evil. And good people are honest, they're selfless, and they, unlike bullies, they self-critique. They constantly are looking at themselves and saying, "What did I do wrong? How can I do better?" And so, you know, I tried to sort of like do that in my life in her honor. So anyhow, she died that Tuesday, and she was buried that Friday. We played our state championship game on a Saturday, and we played a team that featured the fastest kid in New Jersey, and he ended up playing the NFL for 12 years. We beat him in the last minute. Then we had to take our SATs on Sunday, and then we had to take our we had a Thanksgiving game that following Thursday. And I got the SATs back, and all my friends, I went to public school, you know, and my friends to this day say someone else took my SATs for me, because then I got recruited by Harvard and Princeton and Yale and all the Ivies and the service academies, and I got some Division I scholarships for football. And that's how I ended up going to Brown. My dad sort of disappeared, and I was left to deal with the recruiters on my own. And I actually responded very well to West Point. I stayed with a quarterback there, and I liked the whole approach, discipline, and the structure. I had responded very well to that in high school under my coach. But the coach at Brown just wouldn't get off my tail, and I don't, you know, he was a bully. I told him, I said, "I love your attention, thank you, but, you know, I like West Point." And he was always negatively coaching recruiting against Princeton. Princeton heavily recruited me as well. And so I ended up going to Brown because he said, "Well, you know, if you go to West Point, you're never going to get in the NFL because you have to do your military." And that was, like, outlandish. But I said, "Well, if that guy believes in my skills and abilities, that must be a good place to go." And that was bait and switch. Once I got there, you know, he never treated me poorly, and he did say some really nice things to me in my career. But, you know, it didn't turn out to be the school that he had pictured or depicted. So I guess that's a good time to switch, right, to take a break?
Sure. Let's go to our panel and get them to comment on what they've heard so far. So we'll go to Mary first. Mary Havens?
Well, Matt, you have so much information there, and my mind just keeps going from one thing to another. But I wanted to say that I had read the book called Conversations with a Pedophile, and when you were describing the Boy Scout experience, it made me think of the man who used the Boy Scouts to molest, I don't know, thousands of kids. And he's in prison and will never get out. I think, too, that the whole idea of how your father sort of liked these people, and that's one of the characteristics of a pedophile, is to befriend the parents to get to the children. And so your father was really not your advocate nor your protector. And they do know how to target their victims. And, you know, I think that's an education that it sounds like you're teaching other people how to look for those sorts of things, even though you're doing it in a workplace. But what you teach to adults can also be taught to children. The only other question I had was, did the neighbor who abused you abuse anyone else, or was he ever caught and reprimanded?
He was never caught or reprimanded, and from what I know, he never abused anybody else. The Boy Scout leader, he died. He never touched me. The neighbor, when I was young, I was thinking about doing something stupid and going in and going back and trying to find him. But I think he may be gone. I think he may have perished as well. He was not a healthy person.
Okay. Thanks very much, man.
No,
good question.
And I think the laws now, if I had disclosed, and you tell me whether this is true or not, but if I had disclosed that to a psychologist in New Jersey today, wouldn't there be some sort of reporting requirement?
Yes, there is. There are a variety of careers that if you join that career, you're a mandated reporter, and psychologists are among them. So are teachers, so are law enforcement members, and so are medical people, healthcare professionals. They're all they're called mandated reporters now. We would love it if mandated reporting went on with every citizen, and it doesn't, but that, you know, someday we might have that. But there are a couple states that actually do that. It's a misdemeanor only, and everywhere except, I think, Florida and one other state where it's a felony. If they find out later that you knew about children being sexually assaulted and didn't report it, and that's for anybody in their states, in other words. But most states have a set of mandated reporters, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The other thing... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Bill, I want to add too. I want to add too that because of the mandated reporting in 1984 is why and how I uncovered the sexual abuse by my husband. So it has gone back to 1984, at least in the state of Minnesota, where mandated reporting is what really saved us in that situation.
Right. And different jurisdictions. The rules aren't the same.
Yeah.
It's not a national set of requirements. It's jurisdiction by jurisdiction. But most states
have
mandated reporters now. All right, we've got to move on because we only have about 20 minutes left, and I want you to do some talk about what you do as a living.
Yeah, I got to get you up. I got to get you up to speed.
I know, Carol. A quick question or comment?
Yeah, you know, I really quite admire you. Because you did have years there where you were bullied, where you were beaten, where you were sexually abused, and at least you didn't get into drugs, you didn't get into alcohol. Is that correct?
That's correct. I never. I mean, I was clean as a whistle college, other than beer. I was the president of my fraternity, and that was sort of like a – but I didn't drink much beer, to be honest with you, maybe one or two a night. I was not a big drinker, but my coach, I think, instilled that in us. And so, yeah, I mean, clearly all the counselors that I've seen, and I've actively pursued counseling to help with my sleeping problems and everything like that, they all are pretty amazed that I never tried to self-medicate like that or that I'm still around. A lot of people go through this kind of thing.
Thanks, Carol. Bobby Hyde, do you have a question or you just want to listen? All right, he's just going to listen, Matt. So we're going to ask you to move a little quicker because we only have about 20 minutes left, as I said, and I do want you to talk a little bit about the solution. One comment I'd make quickly is that you were blessed, frankly, that you had a psychologist who kind of understood, although he wasn't a mandated reporter, when you were young, and that's really important for people to hear. Today there are lots of people who are dedicated to helping kids as kids. And, of course, we're here because a lot of us anyway are here because we didn't get help as kids. We're now trying to encourage people to come forward and tell their story in an appropriate setting with a therapist, with a minister, with a whoever, with us, so they can begin their own healing journey. All right, so Matt, catch us up to wherever you'd like to, and be sure to include some of what you do as a, you know, as a survivor.
Well, I'll share, you know, from the Brown experience on, I'll ramp it up a little bit. But the I did want to say, I went back in after that Philmont session, and I told my counselor, I said, you know, I'm a starter on the varsity team now, and that was very rare. And he goes, and I told him about the Philmont experience, and I said, you know, I really feel like I'm in control of my life now. And he slammed his hands down on the table, and he said, you're done. He goes, you come back and see me anytime you want, but if you feel in control of your life, you're done. And he had a big smile on his face. And so I think that's the key. Now, do we all have complete control? I think we have control of how we respond to things. You can't control everything that happens to you, but that control was a big issue. And as you know, that's the number one driving force, as Bobby said, of a predator. So anyhow, I got to Brown and had a really good football experience there. I did compress 3 vertebrae, so I had to sit out one semester, and I worked my way back. I had to sit out a semester of football, and I came back and I played 2 more semesters. When I came back from being out and rehabbing, I joined a fraternity and had been thrown off campus. They were animals. It was the Animal House. And the guys that were in there when I was a freshman, I guess, were just crazy. I went down there to a couple parties and I said, I'm not going to join here. I think these guys might kill somebody. And I was serious. And they were good guys. There was absolutely no control, no discipline. So I didn't join. But when I came back, I said, well, how bad can it be? There were only 4 pledges. There were 40 brothers. So as I was pledging, they elected me president because they were trying to get a house back, and they figured I'd be a good person to talk with the administration. So then, in fact, we got a house back. We were the first house at Brown to get a house back. I was the president, was able to play football the following year. We led the league in offense, in rushing, played Penn State, who were reigning national champs, and we almost beat them. We had over 400 yards offense on them. And so, I got to begin football and sort of the structure. My dad remarried, and that my family pretty much was done. Every time they'd call me, they'd be complaining about my brother, my sister. I was training one summer, and I came down, and my sister said, you know, I think my stepmother told my sister that she could fill in as a mother now, and my sister said, you'll never replace my mother, and my father went off the handle, and that's why kept him. That's the only time I ever saw him go after my sister, but he didn't hit her, and then I wrote a letter, very inspiring letter to my brother, and my stepmother and father intercepted it and told me never to write letters like that to him again. So it was, I was pretty much on an island up there because I had moved away from Jersey where my family was, and most of my friends were. So I sort of started a new life up there. In the summers, I worked on Wall Street. My stepmother had lived in New York. She wanted to hang on to the apartment because they thought it would go condo. So I lived there 1 or 2 summers. And, there are a lot of stories I could share that are a lot of fun, but it was generally a good experience. Although it was a tough experience, because I went through, there was a lot of change in my life and my family, and I hadn't really addressed comprehensively all the trauma that happened to me earlier in my life, and I started waking up every night about 2:30 in a cold sweat, and that went on for about 20 years. So, but I just dealt with it. I read an article that said Herschel Walker said he does that, but it's because he has extra levels of testosterone, and I said, well, that must be what my case is, but it wasn't. Mine was related to trauma. So anyhow, at my senior year, a new staff came in, and I would take time after practice to teach the guy that was lining up across from me better technique. He was an exceptional athlete, but he just hasn't gone to a very good high school program. But I needed him to get better so he would be better for me in practice. So I would tutor him after practice, and the coaches came to me and said, hey, you ever think of coaching? And that sort of made everything fall together. So then I coached at Brown for 2 years. I applied for some graduate assistantships, and I was offered one at University of Washington, Seattle, and one with Joe Paterno of Penn State. All my coaches on my staff who had actually worked with Paterno said, go work with Don James at Washington. But my dad said, you know, I screwed up my college decision. He thought I should have gone to Princeton or West Point, and you should go work with Joe Paterno. So that's how I ended up there. And that was just – I never saw any sexual molestation there, but they were wacky. It was like a distorted reality. Jerry Sandusky had this, like, you know, old golly gee type of thing going on. And he had those kids were around all the time from the second mile. One of the young boys, Matt Sandusky, who he ended up adopting while I was there. I obviously probably met when he was there. I never, like I said, I never saw anything, but I've met him through another organization called Male Survivor since then, and I've apologized to him for not knowing more. But there was like a creep factor there, and it was all they were reigning national champs. They had won this national championship in 86. And it was all about power control, all about ego, all about suppression. Most powerful man in Pennsylvania was Joe Paterno. And I don't know, I've heard so many different accusations and stories, but there are court documents that say when I was on the staff, I wasn't at the meeting, I was in class or breaking down film, that Joe Sarah came running into a staff meeting and said he had just seen Jerry raping a boy, and Joe put the kibosh on that. That didn't make it to court. It's in court documents, but it didn't make it in the court. So, and I don't know why, but so it was going on. I just thought it was a very strange dynamic. It wasn't a very healthy environment. It was like everything was on show, and it sort of turned me off. I loved coaching every moment that I played. I was on the field as a coach, I absolutely loved. But it made me question about what I wanted to do. I took some architecture courses down there. And then I came back to URI, and I got an MBA, and I coached football there. And I started giving team-building programs and corporate development programs, and I designed a 50-hour program in the practice of management at Brown. And I really thought, you know, my exceptional sports experiences, particularly playing, and some of my coaching experiences, I'd like to transfer them and help, you know, make organizations or communities or at-risk kids more resilient. And that's pretty much what got me into what I do. I started giving corporate retreats. Companies started asking me, they would come down for these one-day seminars at it was a campus extension at Walton Jones campus, beautiful retreat center, affiliated with the University of Rhode Island. They would ask me what else I could offer, or they asked me to come in-house, and MetLife hired me, so I went in-house as an in-house consultant. They got me certified in a couple programs. I did design that modified MBA for Brown at Knight, exposed me to about 2,500 clients, or people, I should say, and that introduced me to a bunch of clients, two of which EMC and General Dynamics became major clients for about 15, 20 years. And so in a given year, I would have maybe five or six key clients and then probably 30 different engagements that may have been in one day or two. And then I was offering these classes. And about 15 years ago, I just decided to step out on my own, and that's what I've been doing since. And now it's evolved. I've taken all these stories and exposure because I worked internally for a couple of big companies. I was recruited to do the same thing for Cox Communications after I worked for Met. So I was internal for about 10 years as a manager. Saw a lot of bullying, saw a lot of abuse, addressed a lot of it. Then in my consulting practice, it just blew up. You know, when the door shut, I'd hear these amazing stories, horrific stories. And then the Jerry Sandusky catastrophe hit. And I realized that night, I was in Europe traveling for a client. I came back about 2 o'clock, and the guy I played football next to at Brown, he's a judge now. He called me, and we were always teasing each other about being different people on the phones, and he said he was Jerry Sandusky and he really needed some help. And I said, well, what's that all about? So I went on the computer and I started reading, and at that moment I realized this is why God put me on the earth, you know, to get my story out and to show that, you know, good does beat evil, and that light beats darkness, and it's choice, and positive beats negative. And
right.
So that's pretty much, you know, 6 years ago, I got in contact with a writer from Washington Post. He did an article on me, got picked up by Mike Francesa in New York. He did a interview with me, and then every media house, Dr. Phil, CNN, John King, everybody wanted to hear my story because the unique combination of being a survivor of horrific childhood experiences and then working at Penn State, that combination was sort of unique. And tried to become a spokesperson and an advocate for victims, and
Well, I want to mention to people that the link for your book and your webpage is in the description of tonight's show, so there is a way for them, not only now, but in the future, to find you and read about your book and so forth. And I think it's a really worthy cause out there.
Matt Sandusky
is a member of the NASCA family. I know him very well.
Great.
Met him many times. And he's been on the show a couple of times, too. So we're very familiar with Matt and love him
to death.
And we wish him all the best. Go ahead and finish, though, and we'll go to the panel.
Did you want some questions first, or do you want me to finish up the story?
You can finish the story if you do it briefly, but we only have about 6.5 minutes left total.
I'll just say the title of the book is Successful Leaders Aren't Bullies, How to Stop Abuse at Work and Build Exceptional Organizations. And last year, I got across some people's desks. One woman got back to me through a friend and said it's probably going to take a year to get any sort of a deal because you're a new author. But it's a very compelling story. And then that day, someone from one of the imprints of Simon & Schuster contacted, looking for new nonfiction authors. So within about 2 weeks, I had a contract to do this book. But they wanted it done in eight months. The time span would be about 2 years. So I worked since last June about 12 hours a day, and I got the book together, and it's doing okay. So that's where I am now.
Well, and as I say, that's linked in the description of tonight's show. As is, I don't know if it's your LinkedIn or your Facebook profile, but we have a profile link in there too, so people can find you. In other words, in the future, we're going to go through our panel quickly. Hopefully, we'll leave you with maybe 2 minutes at the end for a final thought or two, Matt. But let's go to Mary Havens first in Alaska. Mary.
Matt, thank you very much for sharing your story, and congratulations on getting your book out there, and I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Great. All right, Carol?
Yeah, Matt, thank you so much for all that you're doing. It's so important that the schools and other organizations realize just how much sexual abuse is going on, you know, with coaches and all this other stuff. So what you're doing is a wonderful thing, and I thank you so much for coming on the show. And you'll be called back in again sometime soon, maybe within a year, to tell your story again and keep the good work up. And good luck with your book.
You.
You're welcome.
Bobby Hyde, a comment from you?
Here I am, Bill.
Yeah, thank you, Matt, for your story. We discussed this 2 years ago, this Sandusky story. And one of his sons is part of NASCAR, and one of his sons did get into some problems copying his father.
Yeah.
So when you're here telling us that you were you know part of the story, it illuminates more of what kind of an aura or era was going on with these people. And your work, I'm sure, can help the sport world, you know, because we hear a lot of this stuff, you know, controls and go ahead.
No, I appreciate you saying that. Your insights and Carol's too, and Mary, the real push now, I'm shifting a little bit. A lot of my work has been in corporations, but with my background, the reason I got into coaching was to help people like me that might have been overcoming horrific things with sports, with football, because that it was like a family for me. It's this incredible. That's how I was able to go through that whole week my mom died. It was this, you know, very supportive, resilient, constructive environment. And that's what I thought football was for everybody. But now with what we're learning, you know, it's not just it's the gymnasts, it's the wrestlers at Ohio State. It's the horrific behavior we saw down at Damascus High School in Maryland with peers, 15-year-old peers abusing one another. A young man died at the University of Maryland last summer because of a bullying boss. So my real emphasis now and push is to help clear athletes, young athletes, high school and college athletes of abuse so they can go through a sporting experience without any abuse, either from peers or coaches, and, you know, get rid of the bullying. And so there's no real national clearinghouse to do that right now. And that's my major emphasis right now. That's what I'm starting to do.
Well, we're here to support doing that. We're a clearinghouse for all kinds of abuses of children. And you can certainly consider us one of those places. If you want to, if you have material that you can present it in article format, we'll be happy to present it on your behalf and under your name as a part of the NASCA family. And by the way, Matt, Carol mentioned that we have people return. We usually wait 9 months to a year or so, but we've had them return as special guests, and they kind of catch us up with where they've been, and that's what she was offering you, that opportunity. But you can also come on any panel any night. We do them 6 nights a week and do that as well.
Great.
One really quick thought. Matt mentioned earlier, for those of you who are listening, that some of what he recalled and some of the clarity that he came up with didn't occur until he was quite a bit older. And this is very common, is the point. So I don't want people who are out there to think that they did something wrong, because obviously Matt got help when he was young, but that doesn't mean he was healed yet necessarily.
No.
It's a constant battle to heal yourself. And if you haven't started, that's okay. We're here every day doing this work every day. And you can write to us. We have a big contact page. We have ambassadors for most of the states now. Many ways to get in touch with us, about 30 things we do that are all free. And anybody who needs it, a survivor or just an advocate or a mother who wants to know about what to do about their child, can come on our website. They're all free and they're all available to anybody. Plus our Facebook groups and on and on and on, and the radio show. So, Matt, in closing, I just want to thank you very much. This was episode 2045, Matt, and you can call it up anytime you want in the future, and you know, because it'll stay in our archives and it's available as an on-demand podcast within about 20 minutes of the show's finishing. And we're delighted to have you back anytime. You want to give us a final comment? You have about 60 seconds.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, the stages, the actual stages, and I think there are a lot of counselors out there, but if you go to a counselor, you want to get someone that ideally is licensed in trauma and has a specialty in trauma. But it's five steps that I've always remembered. Share your secrets. You got to get them out. And you need someone that can really help you integrate them and get them out in a constructive way. And that's why you need someone that's really an expert in trauma. Then identifying your cognitive distortions that are attached to those secrets. You know, what false beliefs do you have about yourself or the world that are due to the trauma? What behaviors are associated with those false beliefs? And then to start making positive choices in every moment. It took me about 20 years to start getting a good night's sleep again. And
I hear you.
You know, and my daughter, who's now 23, was like an infant. She used to come to my seat, and I come home from work, and I just couldn't move because I was so tired. And I said, I got to get something straightened out. So that mobilized me to go back to counseling, and that's been, you know, an ongoing odyssey now for about 20 years. But I finally got good sleep, which I strongly encourage. The last step then is to integrate and surround yourself with other healthy people. And it's doable. You know, light beats darkness, good beats evil, positive beats negative. And good people, honest, selfless, and
there's no shortage of them at NASCA, and you'll never be alone again a day
That's
at
right.
a time if you don't want to be. To reach out to us here.
That's
Matt,
right.
thank you so much. Our guest tonight was Matt Packness. He's from Massachusetts. He gave us quite a story and reminded us at the end of what he told us that his book is called Successful Leaders Aren't Bullies. It's linked in tonight's show along with a link to his social media profile, and we invite you to get in touch with Matt anytime you wish. This is Bill Murray in Los Angeles thanking you for being with us this evening. We take tomorrow night off. We'll be back Sunday night. Six nights a week we do shows. The only night we don't do a show is Saturday. May God bless you and the children of the world. And God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.